Hey, our lesson this morning is based on chapter 8 of the testimony of St. John. I've told you before that there's a general pattern in St. John. It tends to be two stories that seem to be dissimilar, don't see a particularly connecting theme, and then a long discourse attributed to Jesus, which is unlikely he ever exactly made, since there's no sign that anybody went around writing down things as he said them, but that amplifies, probably the writer of John amplifying these accounts that he's heard in terms of principles that tend to be very Gnostic. And of course, John's gospel doesn't fit in with the others because it's a whole different approach, which is a very Gnostic approach. Now, chapter 8, you may have noticed, just doesn't seem to follow that pattern. And the reason apparently is that if we take this first story in it, the woman caught in adultery, number one, it doesn't show up in most of the early manuscripts of John. It appears later as something inserted in. Take it out, and we have primarily just a continuation of the discourse that was in John 7. And it's sort of like someone just stuck this in there. On the other hand, the story has an important principle involved. So we're not particularly going to ignore it or skip it, but we recognize it may not have been part of the original text, not that that matters to us greatly, except it explains why the pattern that we keep seeing in John is broken here, and why really 7 and 8, chapters 7 and 8, with the exception of this story that's just stuck in the middle there, tend to flow together. On the other hand, that makes it very long, so we broke it up, just like whoever divided the chapters did. So we'll start with this story of the woman who was caught in adultery. Now the problem was, of course, that she was breaking the rules of orthodoxy. The orthodox teachers have brought her to Jesus as a test to him. They're not really that concerned with the woman, but they're testing Jesus, trying to find an offense in his teachings for which they can condemn him. In other words, they already suspect that Jesus doesn't care what this woman was doing in the privacy of her own room, presumably. I doubt she was out in the marketplace. But, so they're suspecting that Jesus is going to respond in an unorthodox way, and that's exactly what they want, and that's the reason they're doing this. Because they want to be able to condemn his teaching because it is Gnostic. So, Jesus simply ignored them. In other words, he knew what was going on. He didn't want to play their game. He just paid no attention to them. He says he just sat there and was writing in the sand with his finger. But they didn't go away. So finally, he said, if there is one of you who has never done anything he shouldn't have done, that is the person who should throw the first stone at her. Because the penalty under their orthodox law was death. They threw rocks at the person until they were dead. I should say they threw rocks at the woman until she was dead in cases of adultery. You notice that adultery is difficult to commit alone. And I'm using the word here simply in an orthodox context. It isn't something you do alone, but only the woman is dragged in. That's part of the whole orthodox setup, you know, that the woman has to be the guilty one and the man really hasn't done anything wrong. He's just been a man. Well, Jesus wasn't arguing whether what she did was right or wrong. That wasn't the issue. His point was, if you consider she's done something wrong, you really only have a right to condemn her if you haven't done anything wrong. Otherwise, you should be minding your own business, that is, tending to your own affairs, taking care of your own problems, and let her deal with hers if they are problems. And then he went back to ignoring them, giving them the opportunity to work through the answer themselves, which was the only thing that would work. He could have given them a long lecture on this, but they weren't his disciples. They had no commitment to learning from him. They weren't open to learning from him. It would have been totally wasted. His only possibility was that by saying this one sentence, it might open their minds to be able to perceive for themselves the reality of the situation. It either would or it wouldn't. 50 sentences wouldn't have helped. In fact, that would almost have ensured it not working. And this is a good key when you're dealing with people, or if you're in a teaching situation with people who do not have a commitment to learn from you. Even people with a commitment to learn from you have enough trouble doing it. But if they don't have a commitment to learn from you, there's no sense heaping things on them, because it's only going to build their blocks against it. Sometimes the right word or the right sentence can, what we call, crack the door. Just open their minds just a little so that they can begin to receive. And that's what Jesus was doing here, was trying out cracking the door. Well, the text says that as those who were listening began to examine their consciences, they left one by one, beginning with the oldest. Usually this statement, beginning with the oldest, is taken as a suggestion that wisdom comes with age. But any of us who have known people know that that isn't necessarily true. Sometimes wisdom comes with age. There's a certain tendency that after you've gathered enough experience, you might learn something from it. So it's realistic to think that wisdom may come with age. On the other hand, as one Gnostic teacher put it, I've known many a gray hair, well, this was in the 1800s, he said silver head back then, I've known many a silver-haired man of 70 who didn't act any different than a six-year-old child. And that's true too. Wisdom doesn't always come with age. But this story is saying that that's a possibility. More likely, however, I think it suggests that the oldest had done more things they shouldn't have done. So it was easier for them to see what Jesus was saying. Young people tend to feel that they're right in what they're doing. Fanaticism is usually an attribute of younger people who have had less experience with their own weaknesses. Now, when you get an old fanatic, you really have trouble, because they're really blinded to themselves, and they don't know themselves at all, and they're really hard to deal with. But fanaticism in the young is a pretty natural thing, and that's why we have these movements of young people that are very extreme, because they haven't yet found themselves in the scheme of things, so they don't see things with a balance, because within us, oh, there is this balance. We know that we do things we're glad we did, and we do things we wish we hadn't done, and that makes it harder to be extreme with ourselves or with others. So the older ones might have been able to perceive this more easily because they had more experience of their own humanity, even though they wouldn't have been there in this situation if that had been very prominent in them. Jesus was able to bring it out in them first. But gradually it worked down, and perhaps because of the example of the older ones leaving, the young ones may have suddenly thought, what's going on here, and seen themselves a little more clearly. So it worked down till they all had left. Not a one was left. The principle here is, number one, you cannot judge the lives of others. When this person was brought to Jesus to judge her, he didn't try to judge her, and that's what he said to her later. She said to him, there's nobody left accusing me. And he said, well, I'm not accusing you either. We don't judge the lives of others because we all are trapped in the human condition. And we are all human, and there's no one who hasn't done anything wrong. I'm reminded of Jimmy Swagger, who was so extreme in his preaching that people expected him to be absolutely perfect himself, because he was so condemning of anyone who didn't follow his line of orthodoxy. And yet he was out doing the very things that he was condemning. Now, I don't think badly of him for that. I think badly of him for not learning anything from that so that he would stop condemning people. Because he was human. He should therefore have realized that others can be human. If he wanted to help people learn how to evaluate better, he wanted to help people learn how to find greater strengths to call on, that would have been legitimate. But to be condemning people for being human, as though you weren't human yourself, is to be cut off from reality. And that's really the message of this story with the so-called adulterous woman. And that, and then we get back onto the discourse that we really had started in chapter 7. It says, later, when a crowd had again assembled around Jesus, he said to them, I am the light which has descended to the mortal plane to enlighten mankind. He didn't say, I'm bringing light. He said, I am the light. Now, this should tell us a whole lot about interpreting these scriptures. Because we have Jesus as the personification of light and And light in these scriptures means that which is positive, that which is uplifting, that which is reaching out and encompassing. Light is all the positive things in this whole book of John, and darkness is all the negative things. That's how they're described. Jesus says, I am the light. So he's telling us right here that we're dealing with an archetypal figure here. Whether Jesus was a man who said anything like these things or not is not the issue. What's the issue is that he's being given to us here as an archetypal figure to carry to us the light. He said, I am the light who has descended to the mortal plane. That is, who is coming out in us as mortals to enlighten mankind. That is, to, the word enlighten is very important here, to make us light-filled. So that we are working from a position of light, thinking in terms of light, acting in terms of light, which means in terms of all the positive things that make this world better, that make life better, and make us better. Not a list of rules of what we should do, but a concept of goodness and of bringing that goodness into a reality in the world we live in. He went on, anyone who follows me will not walk in darkness. For my disciples received light to illumine the way to life eternal. Now remember that eternal means divine. It doesn't have anything to do with length of time. It's a quality of life that is out beyond and above and fulfilling the mortal potentials that we have, and going beyond them to our full potential. And so he's saying that his disciples receive light from him because they're disciples of light. He said, I am light. His disciples are disciples of light, of goodness, of all the positive things we want. And that radiates from them to show others how to come to a light-filled life, which would be life eternal, a divine life. A life that is radiating light. Another time Jesus said his disciples are like lighthouses set on hills, shining light out to help us see the realities of the mortal condition, and so we don't break on it. But we can maneuver through them to that light-filled quality of life ourselves. Well, it says that the Pharisees, those who belong to probably the most, or at least one of the most orthodox sects among the Jews. In fact, what I call orthodox Jews today are the philosophical descendants, at least, of these Pharisees. That was the beginning of Orthodox Judaism. So obviously, it's Orthodox thinking. They objected to what Jesus said on the basis that he had no one else to substantiate his claim. In other words, he says, I am the light. I am bringing you to the light. I can transform your life. And they said that in their law, it said you have to have at least three witnesses to anything before you have to believe it. So they said, Jesus, you've only got yourself to witness. Jesus' reply was that it really didn't matter. They were just, which is obviously the truth, they were just trying to throw up barriers to what he was saying. They didn't really care about the reality of it. They already didn't believe it from the beginning, so they were trying to put barriers in it. He said, it didn't matter because I know where I came from and where I'm going, but you can't tell where I came from or where I'm going. In other words, he had gnosis, he was saying. One early 2nd century, I believe, Gnostic teacher said that what distinguishes a Gnostic is knowing where he or she comes from, where we are heading, why we're in the mortal condition, and what we can do while we're here, what we can accomplish while we're here. In other words, to be in touch with reality. And Jesus is saying that right here. I know where I'm coming from, I know where I'm headed. That gives validity to what I have to say. I don't have to worry about your rules that you set up to decide whether I know what I'm talking about or not. Jesus said that the Pharisees did not know these things because they couldn't see beyond the physical plane to the reality which, he said, I represent, because you are limited to the perceptions of mortal mind. Now, in technical terms, this is called being sensual. To be sensual means that you're limited to the perceptions of the physical senses, and you can't see anything beyond it. And Jesus was saying, if you're in that situation, then you can't perceive the reality I'm talking about anyway, so this is all irrelevant to you. And if you can see the reality, then I don't need any other witnesses. Now, this isn't exactly what he said, but if you analyze what he said far enough down, it comes to this same thing. I don't need any other witnesses because you'll be able to see it for yourself. So either way, your standards you're setting up are irrelevant. Then he said, I am not a native of the physical plane. Now he's speaking here for every Gnostic. One of the things that Gnostics feel is alienation from many of the aspects of this mortal existence, because they've seen the potential for something better. Now it doesn't mean that they therefore back off and hide themselves in the desert or on a mountaintop. It means, however, that they recognize that they're not trapped in the nature of this mortal existence, that they can do something better with life, that they can live above it even while here. And so the Gnostic deity has sometimes been called the alien god. We have a book by that name, which is so-so actually, but the title's good. The alien god, because it's the god of those who have realized their alienation from the basic way existence works here, and have come to the determination to live life better than just the way it naturally works. And that's what Jesus is summarizing there when he says, I'm not a native of the physical plane. He's not saying I'm not here. He's saying, I don't see this as my origin. I don't see this as my limitation. And no Gnostic does. Nor, he said, does my testimony concern physical things. So you are incapable of evaluating whether it is true or false, because they were limited to physical-mindedness. That was already obvious in what they had to say continually. They were just centered in this physical existence. So really, the things Jesus said were nonsense to them. They made no sense. And he was saying, that's fine. You just work to get physical-mindedness, so let me talk to these people who are wanting to see something more. Only those who are seeking truth on the spiritual plane can discern the reality of what I teach, he said. So, we don't go out and try to bring everyone around to perceiving Gnosis. We try to let people know that it's there, believing that those who are ready, and that doesn't mean that the one who's not ready today won't be ready tomorrow, but just to make the opportunity to those who are ready to come and work with us to grow and understand the potentials that we have and possibilities life has. But we realize that vast numbers of people aren't even interested yet. Sometimes it takes specific events in their lives to prepare them, to make them open, or whatever. And that's fine. So Jesus said there are two ways to go about finding people in a situation like this. You can do it as a hunter or a fisher. And in those days, fishermen didn't use a rod, they used a net. You throw a net, just draw in crowds, but you get all kinds. Or you can just be out there and find the ones that are right for it. Bring those in, like a hunter who picks just exactly what he's looking for to capture. And that's the Gnostic approach. Well, then Jesus mentioned his father and mother, referring to his divine source. So one of the Pharisees asked him, where are your father and mother? Thinking he means his physical parents. This is the continual thing going on here, is the difference between the physical view and the metaphysical view. And that's the whole difference in the approach to John, between the physical view you would get in an Orthodox approach and the metaphysical view you would get in a Gnostic approach. But Jesus replied, you don't even know who I am. How can you know who my father and mother are? If you realize who I am, you would also realize who my father and mother are. So he's saying, you relate to me as an illusion, really, as who you think I am. You don't know the real me. If you don't know the real me, you can't know the source I come from. If you knew the real me, you could know the source I come from, because you would be then perceiving metaphysically instead of just physically. But as it is, you can't know. Then on another occasion, Jesus said, I'm going to go away. When I do, you will look for me, but you cannot go where I am going because you refuse to rise above the physical plane. Consequently, you must die, wrapped in the effects of the illusion of separateness. Well, people began to immediately speculate on the meaning of what he said, trying to figure out where he's going. Some said he's going to kill himself. Is that why we can't follow him where he's going? Some said he's going to go to another country where we can't go. To us, Jesus seems to be speaking plainly. But to their literal-mindedness, David Romanus was blocking the plain meaning of his words. So Jesus then, in fact, emphasized this difference in outlooks as a difference in being, saying the way you look at things is the way you are. That is, I don't mean to say, the way I said it almost sounds backwards. You see things as a reflection of yourself. So the way you look at things is really a reflection of what you already are. So he said, you are totally centered in this physical existence. I am centered in spiritual reality. You have made yourselves part of this world of darkness, but I walk in the realm of light. You cannot understand me because I speak of the reality which is in the realm of light, but you try to understand me according to the illusions of darkness, for these constitute your world. So each of us lives in a world of his own making, and that world is a projection of what we have made of ourselves. The only way to change the world in which we live is to change ourselves. So Jesus doesn't have a lot of programs for changing the world around you. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with those, or that they might not be legitimate things that come out of us, but I'm saying that we have to start with making of ourselves what we perceive we want to be. And then we'll see what comes out of us, and it will be the appropriate thing, because it will really be a genuine manifestation of what we are. Then Jesus explained that only when you accept him as the one who can free you from the illusions of mortal existence will he be able to free you. He can only free you when you accept him as the one who can free you. Now, that's important because we're talking about an archetypal figure. And without finding that archetype within us that can free us, we can't be free. That's what we have to come to. We can try to be free by rebelling, but that doesn't free us. It just makes us slaves of a new master, which is rebellion. But if we can find within ourselves the archetype of freedom, which we call Christ, then that archetype can teach us how to be truly free. We have to find that free reality that is unconsciously within us in order to be free. Well, then someone asked him, who are you then? Not getting the point yet. Jesus explained, when you have exalted the Son of Man in your hearts, you will know I am. Two key archetypal terms there. The Son of Man. Jesus called himself the Son of Man. Now, in doing so, he was referring to the divine in Gnostic terms as divine anthropos, which means divine human. When he said Son of Man, it's not being used in a masculine term, but as the full potential of what mortals can be is divine anthropos in the Greek. And Jesus being an archetype of transition to that, an archetype that shows us how to make the transition to that full potential we have, is the Son of Man, or the projection of man onto a level that we can deal with it. So it's an important phrase that only occurs occasionally. Later preachers have used it a lot, but they don't even know what it means. They don't even have a theory for what it means, which they put out. Or if they do, it's pretty convoluted. But in the scriptures, it occurs only occasionally. It's always archetypal, and it always relates to our divine potential and the Christ figure as the archetype to help us make the transition from what we are to what we can be. And he says, when you have exalted the Son of Man in your hearts, in other words, when you have enshrined that as what you look to discern what you can be and to discern the effects of the choices you make, then you will know I am. That's the second archetypal term. Now the name Jehovah, which is very corrupted from the original, but the name from which that comes means the self-existent one. It means he or she that is, that exists, period. And that's referring to our potential again, to not be dependent on something else, but to find within ourselves the source of life that Jesus is unfolding to us here. And then when we do that, we can say, I am. I exist. Well, all through this testimony of St. John, Jesus keeps saying, I am, in little key places. Now, according to the Greek, if he'd said, I am a man, I am a God, I am a tree, that doesn't mean anything special, any different than it does in English. But when it just says, I am, it has this implication that we're talking about of the divine name. It's an unfolding of the deity, and it's saying that it is the fullness of what we have the potential to be. So that each of us can come to that place where we can say, I am, without adding anything after that. And that's what makes it the divine name. Right now, perhaps I would say, I am a human being, I am a man, I am an American, I am a Gnostic, I am a father, or I'm saying things that I might say. You change them slightly perhaps. But the point is, I can say all those things and those are all fine, but when I can just say I am, then I have found my divine reality. And I'm not just any thing or collection of things, I am in this sentence. That's the point we're growing to. Our account goes on. The conviction that accompanied these words pierced the hearts of many of his hearers so that they believed that he was who he claimed to be. In other words, when he said it, they felt the reality of it. Many of those who were before still being physically minded suddenly were hit with, when Jesus said, I am, it meant something. And they got the import of it. So then Jesus said to those who believed in him at that point, if you continue to acquire gnosis through me and live by the principles I teach, you will be my true disciples. So a disciple is one who learns principles and works at applying them. Now, I hope you see that in a totally different light than someone who learns rules and lives by them. Because principles have to be applied, and there's no absolute ways to apply them, because principles always conflict with one another. Learn principles for a while, and you're bound to hear one that negates one you heard a little while ago. And they're both valid. In a set of circumstances, using the techniques we learn for evaluating and perceiving the reality of the circumstance and perceiving what might apply, then you learn how to put these conflicting principles against each other and see what you really should do. Because usually what you should do is not any of the extremes stated in the principles, but something that comes out of their working, I'm saying against each other, I don't want to mean it in a negative sense, but working, chipping against each other, I guess there's no other way to put it, so that something new comes out. And we call this, we describe this process as when we start to think through a situation, that we start with a thesis, we see a principle that looks like it applies. And the thing to do is always look for its antithesis. What's the opposing principle? There will always be an opposing principle. Now, you might not know it yet, but hopefully you do. Or you may learn it out of the experience, or whatever. But there's an opposing principle. And then if you bring those principles together, they'll rub against each other until out of the thesis and its antithesis, we get a synthesis, which is the right thing to do. We'll see clearly the right way to act in this situation. That's our approach to decision making and knowing the appropriate thing to do. So it's not a list of rules we get, but it's principles that we can apply in this process to come through to what we should do. Then he says, you will learn of truth, and truth will set you free. Truth being reality. Truth being that in which we really live. And knowing it sets us free from all the illusions of mortal existence. In their egocentricity, they couldn't accept that they were slaves. So they could see no reason they needed to be set free. So Jesus explained further. He said, I tell you the truth when I say that ignorance makes a person a slave of darkness. See, you may not feel like a slave, but because you're ignorant of so many realities, you are a slave to that ignorance, or through that ignorance. Through that ignorance, you're a slave of darkness, is how he put it. The Son of the Elohim has come to lift you out of slavery and make you part of the family of the Elohim. That is, being part of the family is freedom. If you're part of a family under the social structure that these people understood, you are free. A slave was not part of a family. A slave might have children. A slave might have a partner. but they could be sold into separate countries. They had no family stability. So Jesus is using that illusion to say, you will be made free, so you become part of the divine family, where there is freedom. Only the Son of the Elohim has the power to free you from darkness, because he's the archetype that teaches us how to make the transition to the being divine. And only by being deified ourselves can we rise above all the things that enmesh those who are mortal. Well, then Jesus clarified some of the misunderstanding that was aroused by his frequent references to his parents. His Jewish disciples in this discussion say, well, our parents are Abraham and Sarah. That is, their progenitors were Abraham and Sarah. And so they were claiming, therefore, we're free. We're not slaves. Still missing the point here. These are disciples here. These are people who are trying. But they're still not getting very far above their physical languages. Jesus says, if Abraham and Sarah were your parents, you would do the things they did. In other words, they were also prototypes of Gnostic seekers. Their stories are given as to outline principles in our quest. If you really look to them as your progenitors, you're going to do the things they did. You're going to be seeking these same experiences. The things you do, he said, show who your parents are. In the homily to the Hebrews, whoever wrote that, says we have two kinds of parents. We have our physical parents. Everybody has those, and as we grow up, we try to honor them, but of course they often fall short of what our desires for parenthood are. But he said, we also have our metaphysical parents. And if we transfer that parental need to them, then we will live. That is real life. We may have good relationship with our physical parents, we may have a bad relationship with our physical parents, but our parents are there to hold out before us the potential of a parental archetype that is within us. And when we hook into that archetype, we will find what we need to get from parents to allow us to grow into our potential. That's the parenthood that matters, not who we claim we're descended from. Not that there is no value to us, but it isn't going to help us transcend mortality. It's totally enmeshed in mortality. So Jesus is looking at parents on another plane, in another way. Suddenly, realizing how much of themselves they've revealed in all this, the disciples backtrack, and now they want to claim the Elohim as their parents. He said, well, we are children of the Elohim after all. But Jesus points out that they do not live according to the pattern of the Elohim any more than they live according to the pattern of Abraham and Sarah. That the parental archetype is an example for you to follow in your development. That's what makes it your parents. And so he says your parents can be, and he talks here about darkness as a parental force, just as light can be a parental force in the personified in the Elohim. Whatever you choose as the archetype toward which you grow is your parental archetype. You can claim one and grow to another, but the reality is that the one you're growing toward, the one that is shaping your image, is the true parent. You reject my teaching because you cannot understand the spiritual truths it contains, he said. You cannot understand them because they are contrary to your nature, which was physically centered. You'll forget that just by hearing all the things they say. Your nature, which you have inherited from your parents, the gods of darkness, that is, they were centering in illusions, and therefore that made the source of illusions their parents, because that's the example they're going into. When I come teaching of truth, you won't believe me because you are so deeply immersed in their deceptions. And that's why this parental thing is important. It makes the difference on what you can perceive and what you can't, and how you can go and how you can't. Well, Jesus' opponents are not doing too well in all this, of course. So they drop to name-calling, which is usually where people go when they can't make much headway. But Jesus just summarily rejects this point. And then he says, I tell you the truth when I say that a person who follows my teachings will never die. As though they weren't having enough trouble already, is what he's saying. So his opponents, of course, come back with the obvious. Well, all the great masters and teachers have died. So obviously, you're trying to deceive us. And I guess that's what most people would say if you or I made the same statement, right? That's a pretty natural response, but it means they have no idea still what he's talking about. Jesus says, it doesn't matter who I claim to be or what I say about my teachings. What does matter is that my father and mother, whom you claim as your gods, testify to the validity of my teachings through the power of their spirit. You claim them as your gods, but you don't know them. That's the Orthodox condition. Now, the Orthodox would say that they have the same gods. They don't say God. The same God we do. And that's open to debate, but why bother? The point is they don't know the God we know. They don't see the divine as an archetype of their own potential. They don't see it as the fulfillment of what they are. The concept of divine anthropos throws them into a rage. Literally. I'm sure you get some foaming at the mouth over that one. And all you have to do is read what their progenitors had to say about it when it was more commonly known. And it just infuriated them, that idea. Well, they didn't. If we have the same God, it just means that they don't know the God they have. Or more likely, we really have different gods, but they're thinking they're the same God. Because really, their God is the demiurge, isn't it? It's the projection of what they feel projected out there. And so they imagine in God all the emotions they have, all the reactions they have. They describe God in terms of what they think. And Gnostics are not totally above this. We can't be and still be human. Going to come up sometimes that we do that. But at least we know we're projecting. And at least we know that ultimately it's the unknown God that is so far above what we are that we only get glimpses. And we only get them if we're open to perceiving that it's that God is alien to us as mortals. But that we're growing into what that divine is so that little by little, we can begin to see its reality. But it's very different from whatever we were when we started. Which is all for the good, because we'd like to become quite different from what we were when we started. So, it all works out. Then Jesus says, I do know them. And that's our Gnostic potential. We may not start out knowing the divine, but we do come to know them as we have experienced the growing Gnosis. If I were to deny that I know them, I would be lying, just as you are when you maintain that you do know them. Gnostic lie, I guess. Your father Abraham was shown my ministry, and he rejoiced at what he saw. He believed the principles which I have come to reveal, so he never really died. So he's saying Gnosis has been in all ages. It isn't something that I'm starting now. In fact, it's been in many different cultures. There were Jewish Gnostics, there were pagan Gnostics, there were Zarathustrian Gnostics. Gnosis existed over, there were Greek, well, that's pagan, Gnostic. It existed across various cultures and even across various religions, although they tended to have the same archetypes, even if they called them by different names, and the same general principles, even if they approach it a little differently. But it was always there. And true transcendence of death, therefore, has always been there as a potential. Now, that only when you stop looking at death as laying a body down and look at death as not living and growing in reality does it make any sense. Then you see that if you're really alive, even if your body starts functioning, you don't stop being alive. And if you weren't really alive, well, you weren't alive, even if you had a body moving. That isn't the way we define life and death anymore. But those listening said, you're not even 50 years old yet. How do you know what happened to Abraham? And Jesus replied, let me remind you that I am existed before Abraham. Again, saying, I am the archetype of independent life. That is life that is not dependent on anything that is self-existing. And therefore, I can tell you, I am not trapped by time, when I say to you. The past, the future, is all the present when we rise above this segmented existence of mortality. But when Jesus uttered the divine name, it wasn't lost on the people. They knew what he was saying. And so they picked up rocks to throw at him, because their tradition said that anyone who spoke that name must die. The tradition had come out by then that he couldn't use them. However, Jesus did not follow their traditions, but the teachings of the Elohim. Why do the Gnostic teachers get so upset? I don't know. Why do the Orthodox teachers get so upset with Gnostics? They always have. We go back to the earliest records that mention Gnostics, and they're just really angry with them. And today they get really upset too with them. They don't have quite the same potentials for causing harm, but that doesn't stop them from wanting to. Why? Because Gnostics just will not follow their traditions. They will not follow what they set for them. They follow the teachings of the Elohim, that is, they follow the reality that comes out of our divine hyperconscious, that which is not based on the projections of mortal mind. They can lift us above that. So it says, when they picked up rocks to throw at him, Jesus covered their eyes so they couldn't see him. Which essentially is saying how it is with the Orthodox. They really don't even see what it is we're saying or being. They don't notice any harm really, because they won't even touch what we are. It's sort of like when they do attack Gnosis, it's the old story of they try to say what Gnosis is, but since they can't understand it anyway, what they say never is really Gnosis. Then they refute it, show how it couldn't be true, and very possibly it isn't, but it wasn't Gnosis in the first place. It's invisible to them. It's only visible when our minds are transformed. When we say, when we put on the mind of Christ, it is we begin to see from an archetypal perspective, then Gnosis begins to make sense, and then pretty soon it's the only sense. And then mortal existence begins to make sense. Not as mortals see it, but as we see that it really is. And then we begin to be able to take control of our lives. We're empowered by the fact that we're beginning to see reality. And yet, in a sense, we then become invisible for all these with the Orthodox mindset. They think they see us, but it's no longer seeing who we really are, or where we're really acting, or what we're really perceiving. We become these kind of illusions in that world. That's what it's telling us in terms of Jesus, too. That's basically the lesson of John 8, and next time we're going to John 9, and I think truthfully, I haven't looked at it yet in the last little bit, but I think we go back to a more normal pattern that we've been seeing as we've gone through John. Amen.